everyone, welcome back to Who's There. I'm your host, Allison. If you're new here, thank you for joining us. This is a podcast where I talk to a new horror fan every week because I hope to destigmatize what it means to be a horror movie fan. Because most of us are just regular people who like the adrenaline rush of being scared for some reason, and here we delve into those reasons. Happy Halloween! Today, I'm excited for you to hear my extended conversation with horror author and playwright Nat Cassidy. His newest novel, Nestlings, drops today if you're listening to this on the day that it's released, which is also Halloween. It's a cross between Rosemary's Baby and Salem's Lot, and it's fantastic. I just finished it last night, and I had no idea where it was going. This is also a super interesting horror novel because it's a vampire story told through a Jewish lens. We talk a lot about Jewish horror movies and the few Jewish horror novels that are out there too. As always, please take a second to rate and review us wherever you listen, and let's get into my conversation with Nat Cassidy. Hey Nat, how are you?
I'm well, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here on this rainy, rainy Saturday morning in New York City.
Saturday's got to be rainy for some reason.
I know.
These are the rules.
I mean, it's October, so I'm kind of okay with it.
Yeah. As long as it's not cold rain. I actually like, you know, 50, 60 degree rain up to like 90 degree rain. I love all that. Once it gets cold, then I hate rain. I hate precipitation of any kind. I hate snow. I hate it all.
Oh, okay. Well, have you written any books about horror and snow?
No, Nestlings is set during those awful, like, post-holiday winter months. It's like January, February. Mm-hmm. So there's some moments of snow in it.
Yeah.
But it's not like a snowbound horror novel. No, I haven't messed with snow yet. Oh, I did write a radio play once. Ooh. About a couple who was trapped with their sociopathic child during a blizzard. And then they wind up killing and putting him in a crock pot and then eating him for a stew. So I did write that. That was kind of wintery.
That sounds terrifying and amazing. All right. Well, we're going to talk about your new book, Nestlings, in a little bit. But do you want to start by telling everyone a little bit about yourself?
Oh, well, I feel like I just told them so much already. I'm a lunatic who writes about child eating for audiobooks, audio dramas. No, hello. I'm Nat Cassidy. I'm a playwright, horror novelist, actor, musician. My first book came out last year called Mary, which is a horror novel. And my next book is coming out in 10 days as we're recording this, called Nestlings. And yeah, I've written a bunch of horror plays, horror screenplays. I act a lot. I've been in a bunch of TV shows that you might have seen me playing a bad guy in, like Law and Order and Blue Bloods and Quantico and Bull and FBI and you name it. Sometimes I jokingly refer to them as your parents' favorite TV shows because everybody's parents love to watch New York procedural crime dramas. And yeah, I'll end it there. I could go on. I've written a bunch of stuff and I watch a lot of horror.
Awesome. So first things first, what's your favorite scary movie?
Oh, that's not an ominous question at all. I knew you were going to ask this. And yet whenever I'm asked this, my answers fly out of my head because I am a horror obsessive. It's like my most passionate genre. It's the thing I'm most passionate about, rather. And there's so many different types of horror and so many different subgenres, so many different flavors. I think my generic answer, my go-to answer, is usually The Exorcist or one of two movies to have ever like really scared me as an adult, which is The Ring or Candyman. So those are my go-to answers, but it really does change kind of depending on the mood.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. But The Ring is my all-time favorite horror movie. So
it's so good. It's so good. And is it the American, the yeah, same. I love Ringu. I love it. But I think the American version actually works better. It's one of the few remakes that's, I think, a little bit more effective.
See, I saw The Ring in theaters in 2002, and then I watched Ringu finally for the first time, I think, in 2020 or 2021.
Oh,
I was
yeah.
So bored. It did not work for me.
Yeah, it's a much different experience.
Yeah, the atmosphere isn't there, but maybe it would have been different if I would have watched them in a different order. I don't know.
I saw it in the theaters, too, and it's one of the... I was in college at the time, and it's one of... maybe the only horror movie besides like something like The Blair Witch, which I also saw in theaters when it came out in the late 90s. But we were a younger and more innocent time at that point when the Ring came out, and I was a little bit older, and I was, you know, I was a working actor and was going through a training program in college and all that. So it was like very much living in a behind the scenes acting sort of headspace. And it's one of the only, maybe the only movie I've ever had to like constantly remind myself, this was a movie. It was catered. There was a call sheet. Like they just shot like a scene a day. Nothing bad is going to happen to me. I'm not cursed. I'm not going to die. And I will never forget, I was in a production of Chekhov's Three Sisters at the time. And 7 days had elapsed since I saw the movie. And so I'm sweating it out. I'm like, oh no, I know some of the actors in it. Like Amber Tamblyn was in it. She's not dead. I know she's not dead. Nobody died while making this movie. It's not real. 7 days go by, I'm on stage doing Chekhov, and I'm playing Tuzenbach in that show, which is like a very depressing role, very sad, you know, it's Chekhov. And I'm suffering from unrequited love, and I'm so morose. And the production was staged in the round, so we had audience around us on all sides. And I looked out into the audience, and hand to God, there was a woman with long dark hair that was kind of in front of her face because she might have been asleep, because sometimes Chekhov does that. But I looked out into the audience and just saw like Samara there and almost forgot my lines for a second because I was so terrified that this was it. Like this was 7 days. My number was up. Yeah, that movie got to me. I realized I'm just gonna start rambling. So I apologize.
Yeah, go.
I realized the thing that makes Ring and Candyman so terrifying to me, and there's a couple of other movies that have kind of scratched this itch that have come along later, like Incantation, which is a great, great movie, a Taiwanese movie. But The Ring and Candyman both make you complicit in the movie's sin. Like, you know, you cannot go to Crystal Lake. You cannot, you know, live in Springfield and dream of Freddy Krueger. But you always have a mirror to look in with Candyman, or like they show you the video in The Ring. So you leave that movie effectively cursed. And that is what is so terrifying about it. Like, you know, I'm not going to space, so I don't have to worry about a xenomorph or anything like that. But like, you just showed me this haunted videotape, and now I have to sit and prepare for the fact that I'm going to die horribly. So I love that. I love when a movie like actually makes you complicit in the danger.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. Yeah, I saw it twice in theaters. I think I went back, I saw it once and then went back the next week and saw it again. And I think I was by myself both times. I don't remember being like super like terrified, but I loved the journey of like figuring out what was going on. And that's still what I love in horror movies. And that's why Candyman is another good one, because she's kind of discovering what the myth and whatever. So
yeah, there's this procedural element to it. There's one more thing I want to say about The Ring too that you just reminded me of, and then we can move on to other subjects. But The Ring also has one of my all-time favorite movie moments, and I think that's why it's also like one of my top favorites, because I remember you just saying that made me remember when I was watching it in the theaters, and you get to like the 90% mark, spoilers for a 20 something year old movie, sort of, but you get to like the 90% mark where they, you know, they find her and they set her free, you know, they get into the well and like, oh, and I will never forget sitting in the theater, so cheesed off, so mad. I was like, I was enjoying this movie and it's going to end like every late 90s, early 2000s horror movie is going to end with like, you know, this pat resolution and like, oh, we did it. We set her free and now you don't have to be afraid of her anymore.
Yeah.
And like, I was rolling my eyes and I was preparing to feel as disappointed as I often felt seeing horror movies at that in that era. And then when she tells her creepy little boy what she did and his eyes go wide and he's like, why did you do that? You just set her free. She's horrible. She's evil. And like full body chills hit when I was like, oh shit. I have never gone from hating a movie to loving a movie so severely and so quickly as in that moment, which also like, oh, I love that feeling. I love that procedural horror that you're describing. And then if they can make you get it wrong and pull the rug out from under you, oh, lovely.
Yeah, they showed it at Nighthawk in Brooklyn a few years ago in October. So I went to go see it. It was actually on Halloween, I believe. Nice. So that was really fun. There were so many people who had never seen that movie before. They probably weren't born yet. But but the presenter, the programmer was like, get ready for the most intense PG-13 horror movie you've ever
Yeah.
seen.
Yeah. Basically bloodless. It's so
Yeah.
PG-13.
All right. So for everyone listening, if you haven't watched 2002 American remake of The Ring, please go do that. Thank you. And then
Yeah, forget what I just said about the ending. Go into it
yeah.
as blind as you can.
So how did you first fall in love with the horror genre?
I always have been, like, as long as I've been conscious, horror has just always been, if there's an element of danger and supernatural and, fear to any story, that's just always been the way that I connect to it, I guess. Like, I was raised by a single mom who was also, like, very genre fluent. Like, she loved sci-fi, she loved fantasy, and she loved horror. She was a huge Stephen King fan, so, like, our bookshelves were just full of Stephen King and Dean Koontz and Anne Rice and all that stuff. This would have been the early 80s into the 90s, and so it was always around, and she used to love watching horror movies and stuff like that, so, like, I kind of glommed onto it through her. But yeah, so some of it is nature, some of it is nurture. I feel like the nurture aspect is that. And I go into this a bit in the intro to my previous book, Into Mary. So my mom was raising me and my brother basically on her own, a single working mom, and she had MS also. She had this horrible progressive disease that we were all very aware from, a very early age, that it was going to, like, take her away from us piece by piece by piece by piece over the years. And some years it was slow, some years it was fast, some years it relapsed, some years it didn't. And so that hanging over us, I think, was a very real thing. And also, we're Jewish, and my grandmother fled Poland in like 1929, so, like, right before things started getting real bad. And so my mom, and by extension me and my brother and our very small family, were just kind of obsessed with the Holocaust too. And growing up Jewish, like, you're always just kind of obsessed with
Yeah.
persecution and being on the run
Maybe, yeah, maybe that's why I always loved studying the Holocaust, because I am
Yeah,
Jewish as well, so.
there's something very, like, existential and fascinating about it that you kind of
Yeah.
can't look away from. And I don't know if it's in our DNA or what, but, like, we're always, like, on the lookout for, like, the next threat. Maybe it's because all of our holidays are about that too. Who knows? It's very well reinforced in our belief structure. But so, like, there was that hanging over our heads too, and just that feeling of, like, constantly striving for safety, constantly wondering when the next bad thing was going to happen. So between this historical cloud and this, like, physical, biological cloud hanging over us, I think horror very much became a way in our household, at least for me and my mom. My brother always went more towards, like, sci-fi and things like that, but genre in general, I think, became a way for us to, like, process these really heavy things. So we used to do a lot of bonding together, watching scary movies, talking about Stephen King, just, reading the books that she kind of passed down to me, and, finally getting to graduate to the bookshelves in the living room and stuff like that. So yeah, there's a part of me, I think, that has just always been hardwired to love those sorts of stories. And then there's a part of me that I think finds some great philosophical and existential comfort in those sort of stories. And they've led me to be the sicko that I am today.
You're not sicko.
Thank you. I agree.
Leading on to my next question, why do you think that people who seem perfectly sane love the horror genre?
I was prepared for this question, and I've been asked this question before, and I tend to, as you can probably guess, ramble on this topic a lot too, because I love horror, so I always love talking about horror. And so I was trying to think of a good answer for you that wasn't one that I've given before. And it led me to this thought, this memory. It was something on social media, so it's a little bit cloudy. I don't remember if it was shared with me or if I just came upon it naturally through the algorithm or something like that. And I can't remember if it was a writer or a reader, but it was someone in the romantic genre, either a writer of romance or a passionate reader of romance. And they were talking about this question that is always asked of them: why do you like romance? Like, what is it about romance? Because the story always ends the same. Like, so why do you like reading these stories? And the person responded, yeah, that's the point. And it was this really clarifying moment where, like, yeah, actually, people are drawn to the romance genre because, you know, the bulk of the story, the suspense of the story map is different every time. And you don't know the obstacles that are in the way of these characters finding each other and falling in love and, like, finally becoming a romantic unit. And of course, not every romantic story ends happily, but, like, just speaking generically. But then you get that cathartic payoff at the end that you're always looking for. And it's that repetitiveness, that predictability, that reliability, that is the appeal of the genre. And, you know, this is a really horrible, challenging world. And, like, why wouldn't you want to reliably have that sort of satisfaction in a story? Like, that's a beautiful thing, to want to experience characters falling in love. And, like, I'm not a big romance reader or consumer, but it clarified it for me in a way that I was like, oh yeah, I can really see the appeal of this. Putting that in context of horror, then, you know, this is, to repeat myself, a horrifying world where horrifying things happen, and these dreadful, terrifying things that are out of our control seem to always be happening. Even when you take it out of the context of the world, just like being alive, mortality as an experience is so bananas. It's so, can I curse on this?
Oh yeah.
It's so fucked up. It's so fucking terrifying to have not asked to be born, and then to have had this existence, this actual capital E existence thrust upon us in this very fallible, you know, organic shell that is constantly falling apart and constantly experiencing pain. And you spend some years, like, trying to figure out how to use it. And then you spend some more years trying to figure out how to, like, socialize. And then you reach this point where you sort of have a handle on it. And that's when you really start coming to grips with the fact that it's all about to be taken away from you. And you don't even know what's, like, going to happen after that. You know, it could be nothing, which is just as horrifying, or it could be, who knows? And so horror as a genre, and the people that enjoy horror as a genre, much like romance readers and writers, find a certain comfort in the predictability of reading something where bad things happen, because it's one of the only ways we can actually come to it instead of it coming to us. Like, we're actually taking agency and saying, I'm going to experience a story where horrible shit happens and where I feel unsettled and I feel unsafe. In fact, I hope I feel unsettled and unsafe. I actively want to generate those feelings within myself. And I think that's a really beautiful thing to seek it out, either in preparation of it happening to us or just as a way to, like, you know, finally feel in control of something. I think horror readers and horror writers and enjoyers of the horror genre are probably naturally very empathetic people. They're probably naturally very anxious people. And so, like, it's a way to finally have a little agency in the experience of dread and in the experience of mortality, because it's waiting for us whether we want it to or not, whether we want to deal with it or not. And this genre allows us to not just, like, practice these feelings, but to actually get to experience them on our own terms. And I think that's a very empowering thing.
That's all really interesting. And I think it ties into a question that I always ask later, which is, why do you think that horror fans, or an article came out about horror fans were dealing with lockdown better than non-horror fans? And it's like, probably because we've seen this a bunch of times. We've been training.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, like, well, you know, even if a pandemic hadn't occurred, something bad will happen in all of our lives, probably repeatedly. And horror really allows you to again, like, to kind of practice to there's an old joke that I think about every now and then where, you know, you come upon this man and he's banging his head against the wall constantly. Just, it's so painful looking. And you can tell he's in pain doing it too. Just thud, thud, slamming his head against the wall. And you finally stop him and you're like, hey, why are you doing that? And he says, because it feels really good when I stop. And, like, that's kind of what horror is. Like, we'll just, like, keep banging our head against these stories and, like, experiencing horror after horror after horror. Then we go back to our lives and it's like, all right, this isn't as bad. This, at least I'm not being ripped apart by a shark or something like that. Things feel a little better now.
There have been a bunch of Jewish related horror movies that have come out recently. Have you seen any of them, or do you have any favorite Jewish horror movies?
There's several that I haven't seen that I really need to see. And now I'm blanking on their names. I've seen The Vigil, I've seen Demon. There was that horrible one about the Dybbuk with Gary Oldman as a rabbi from like the early 2000s or something like that, that I'm also forgetting. But there have been
Maybe
so many.
The
Was it
Offering?
called Dybbuk? Oh, The Offering. That's it.
The Offering, yeah.
The Offering. Yeah, that
Yeah,
movie left things wanting. But I loved The Vigil. I loved Demon. But there are a couple of other ones that there's some other like gerund title, like the something that
think there's one called Attached.
Attach. That's what I'm thinking of.
Attachment.
Attachment. Yes.
Attachment. Yeah.
I haven't seen that. I really want to. That seems
Yeah, it was
really
good.
intriguing. Like the it's about like a lesbian couple, right? Who are Orthodox or something like that. That seems really interesting. And there's a couple of other ones that I haven't seen yet. But no, I Nestlings is very much a Jewish story as well. And that was on purpose. Like I wanted to examine like vampire tropes and kind of possession tropes. The inspiration for Nestlings is very much Salem's Lot meets Rosemary's Baby. And both of those stories, while being classics, and especially classics of a very specific era, they're very, rooted in Christian supremacy as far as like mythology goes. And like the cross is effective on vampires, holy water is effective on vampires, or there's a capital D devil who's out there to be the Antichrist and stuff like that. And as a Jewish horror lover, I'm curious if you feel similarly. Like those stories I love, I've got no beef with them, but there's always this interesting little like voice in the back of your head being like, oh, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean that there's an antichrist or that the crucifix works? Like, I don't know how I feel about that. There's just so few examples of a Jewish character experiencing those tropes and wrestling with those questions. There's a great novel that was made into a not great movie called The Keep. It was a F. Paul Wilson novel, and The Keep was made by Michael Mann early in Michael Mann's career. And it is one of the most Michael Mann movies you'll ever see because it's just like, haze and saturated colors and super, super heavy synth soundtrack and so much slow-mo. It's so stylized. And as a movie, it's just like absolute dog shit. An amazing cast. But the book and the story it's telling is set during World War II, and the Nazis have gotten hold of this keep in, I want to say Romania or, somewhere in Eastern Europe. And a vampire type creature is killing all the Nazis like every night. They keep discovering more and more of their men are being bled dry and horrifically murdered. And so the SS officer in charge goes in and grabs a Jewish folklore professor and makes him solve this mystery of what is happening to the men there. And through the course of this investigation, the Jewish folklore professor discovers that a crucifix appears to ward off the monster. And so it becomes this really heavy crisis of faith for him of like, why? What does that mean that the crucifix seems to ward off evil? And ultimately, the story throws a couple of twists and turns in there, and it winds up not being about the crucifix or Jesus or anything like that. It's a bit of a misdirect. But that was one of the only times I've ever read a story that actually like grappled with these themes from a Jewish perspective. So I'm really glad that Jewish horror seems to be having a bit of a moment of a slow resurgence, but a resurgence nonetheless, because it does, Jews by nature are also, we tend to like examine things and ask why about things and stuff like that. So I think it suits those sort of stories anyway.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned before a little bit earlier that, things that scared you in movies were like The Ring and Candyman, because they made you complicit in what was going on. But what scares you in horror movies today? Has that changed, or?
I still love when a movie can be like active with me, can engage with the audience in a really interesting way. And again, that sort of complicity. There's also, I don't know, the older I get, the more I see, and I see, I watch a lot of horror movies, and always have. So like I've been desensitized from a very early age for a very long time. So like I think the things that then work on me the best are the things that have a little bit of a curveball to them, or are structurally unpredictable and are a little bit, I don't want to say experimental, because there is also like that new school of horror movies like Outwaters or Skinamarink that are like extra experimental, and those don't engage me on like a fear level. Like I find them interesting, I find them intellectually interesting, but they don't really like get to me. There has to be some level of narrative coherence and structure for me to like get invested. But then there's got to be some sort of subversion, some sort of unpredictability, some sort of interruption of the rhythm. There's a South Korean horror movie. I adore South Korean horror movies, South Korean cinema in general, and like foreign horror tends to be the most effective for me because of that unpredictability, because of those curveballs that tend to get thrown. And the South Korean movie, Gangnam Haunted Asylum, which is a found
Yeah, I've
footage.
seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, that one got to me.
Okay.
And it got to me because, A, it set up its conventions really well. Everyone's got their headgear and stuff like that. So like, it was the way it was shot was a little bit different for a found footage movie, and like that was interesting too also. But also, do you remember that moment when the haunt, like the possessions start like kicking in, and it's that famous moment where like it suddenly like cuts to the one woman and her eyes are completely black and she's just like muttering this really fast, like almost like insectile, like that sort of like incantation that was happening. And so it was just like so jarring, and it was so uncanny. And the reason why I say like I don't think there were any like words being said, I think even like the captioning said like just gibberish or something like that. So it was like sudden, it was so sudden, it was so abrupt, and it was such a breach of that relationship between the filmmaker and the audience that like that fucked me up. So I need moments like that where like it's
Okay.
sudden and
Yeah.
like it doesn't follow the rhythm of what is happening, but it's still in this structural environment where like I'm enjoying it as a movie. So that tends to really mess me up. Yeah, I think that made sense.
So you like movies with an unconventional structure? Did you see Barbarian?
Yes, yeah, and that's another one that didn't
Yeah.
scare me, but like I enjoyed it in a way that I'm always looking for. Like just to feel unsafe in a structural way was so satisfying. I adored that movie. Yeah.
Oh, so good. And back to Jewish horror for one second. Have you seen Beau Is Afraid by Ari Aster?
No, I haven't yet.
Oh, because
I haven't
I
carved out the time.
yeah, oh my God, it's such a dedicated time block. I went to see it at an early screening where he did a Q&A after, and I didn't know going into it that it was 3.5 hours. I was
Yeah.
like, oh my God, is this over yet? It was good, whatever, but like so long. I was researching like Jewish horror filmmakers, and apparently he calls Beau Is Afraid the Jewish Lord of the Rings. So just thought I'd throw that in there.
I love it. I really want to see it because I love his work
Oh
so
yeah, he's
much.
great. I love it.
And the response to that movie is the sort of response that makes me really excited, because like
Yeah.
so many people fucking hated that movie that I'm like, oh, I can't wait to see this movie. And yeah, 3.5 hours of just like existential angst
Yeah.
that just looks so, I've heard people describe it as like a panic attack in movie form, which
Yeah.
also excites me. There's another Jewish, very Jewish movie that I would say counts as Jewish horror, and it's another A24 joint, Uncut Gems. Like, is
I have heard that that is very
cool.
anxiety producing. I have
Oh,
not watched it yet, but
it's yeah, it will it is also like a panic attack in movie form. You're just constantly like, oh God, no, don't, no. It's so tense. And it's, it's ostensibly like a crime movie or something close to crime. But the dread that it evokes and the panic that it evokes is very horror. So you might really dig it.
if you like panic attacks in movies or a movie as a panic attack, have you seen Shiva Baby?
Yeah.
That,
That's very similar to Uncut Gems. Yeah.
yeah. So before we get into talking about nestlings, who are your favorite authors in the horror lit genre?
Oh, good question. My Pat answer. The easy answer is the most obvious one. Very unknown, kind of obscure author named Stephen King. I think I said already, I'm a Stephen King obsessive. I've read everything he's ever written multiple times, usually. Or not written, I should say. Everything he's ever published, and then some. There are plenty of things that I managed to get my hands on somehow. But yeah, ever since I was a little kid, like I've latched onto his works in a way that I haven't really other with any other authors, except Shakespeare, which was on the acting side of things. That was like my biggest obsession for most of my life. So Stephen King is like the easy, obvious one. And authors kind of in his peer group and galaxy, like Peter Straub and Robert McCammon. But there's a whole host of contemporary authors right now that are phenomenal. You're so many that like I almost hesitate to start naming them because then I'm going to feel awful for the ones I leave out, like, you know, Paul Tremblay and Katrina Ward and Stephen Graham Jones, Cassandra Kaw, Rachel Harrison, Claire McLeod Chapman, Alison Rumfitt. There's more and more and more and more and more that I could name and name and name. But the horror scene right now is just off the hook. It's so good. There's so many good things that are being written and coming out right now. So the less pat but just as genuine answer is all of them. I love all of them. Everybody that writes a horror novel, I love.
Awesome. Yeah, we met at Clay's book launch where you moderated the Q&A. So your new book, Nestlings, comes out on Halloween, which is going to be the day this episode is dropping.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Hello, everybody. Go buy my book. It's out now.
So I'm about halfway through it, like I said before. And although I don't usually like horror literature because it leaves too much to my imagination and my imagination will just go towards the darkest, grossest thing. I'm really liking this because it's psychological, kind of like the movie The Ring, but not gory. And I love that it takes place in New York City and it gives like modern Rosemary's Baby vibes, which is awesome. Do you want to tell everyone what Nestlings is about?
Sure. And thank you very much for that very kind intro. It is about a young couple, Anna and Reed, who've just had a horrible run of luck. They have an almost one-year-old daughter, and the childbirth was very complicated. There was a very, 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 very rare complication that has rendered Anna paraplegic. She's paralyzed from the waist down. She has to use a wheelchair now. And so Anna is dealing with postpartum depression. She's dealing with post-injury depression. She's someone who used to be like a dancer and a personal trainer. She's someone whose coping mechanisms are very physical. And so she's very frustrated with this new reality that she's dealing with. And Reed is finding himself in a caretaker position that he has never been like constitutionally well prepared for. And, you know, they've just been through the pandemic, like the rest of us. It's set like now-ish. It's set like in 2023. So like they lived through the pandemic as New Yorkers, which you can attest was its own very unique hell. The pandemic's been awful for everybody, but New York in particular was like that was on a whole different level. And so like their jobs have been affected. They don't have as much money. They're stuck in this apartment with a really horrible landlord who's a piece of shit and he's very anti-Semitic. They're Jewish, and Reed's mom has just died. It just to make a long story slightly less long, like it just really feels like everything has been going wrong and everything is bad. And out of the blue, their name is pulled in this affordable housing lottery that they entered as like a joke 10 years ago at one of the most historic, beautiful luxury apartment buildings in all of Manhattan, right off of Central Park West in like the early 80s. It's right by the museum. It's right by the Dakota. It's this building called the Detford that everybody enters this lottery because everybody wants to live there, but nobody ever gets to experience this. And their names are suddenly pulled and they're like, oh, maybe our luck is turning. And they go and they look at this apartment. It's the perfect apartment and the perfect location. And the only mark against it is it's at the top floor. It's like the 18th floor, which makes Anna very nervous because what if there's a fire? What if the elevator breaks down? Like, she doesn't know if it's a good idea to accept this apartment, but they decide, fuck it, we're going to do it. We're going to embrace our good luck when we get it. And they move in and nothing bad happens. And it's great and everybody's happy. And that's the end until chapter two. And then they start to realize that the building is maybe not what it seems, that their neighbors are not what they might seem. It's eerily quiet all the time in this apartment building. And, you know, there are like celebrities and movie stars and famous musicians and stuff like that living in the huge apartments below them, but their floor seems very quiet and isolated, and you know, the neighbors that they do meet seem wrong, and their baby Charlie is constantly crying and upset to ever be in the building. So I'll end it there to not give away any spoilers. But yeah, then they start to try and find out what's actually going on in this building, and I'll leave it there.
Awesome. Yeah, everyone should go check it out. It gives me a little bit of anxiety when I'm reading about them like walking down the dark hallways. I'm like, why are you doing that? Just
yeah,
go back to your apartment and pack up and leave. Yeah, because if anything, if like something moves in my apartment on its own, I'm like, I need to burn the apartment down and leave. Yeah. So
one of the many, many, many reasons I wanted it to be a New York set horror story too, is I think as New Yorkers, we, you know, there is that great cliche of like, you move into a haunted house or a house that like something ominous is happening, and people are like, well, just leave. But as New Yorkers, we understand like moving is not easy. Moving yeah. is incredibly difficult. Especially if you have like a baby or, you know,
oh, yeah.
need to use the wheelchair or something like that. Like in their case, this is true. But like for most people, you've probably just blown through all of your money to move. So you can't afford to move anywhere. You can't afford a security deposit. You can't afford to put your stuff anywhere. You can't find an apartment. You can't find an apartment that's in your price range. So like the whole like, why didn't they just leave? Is like, well, they can't because of New York. Moving in New York is one of the worst fucking experiences you can ever wish upon somebody else. So I wanted that to be an element. I wanted that to be an excuse for why they're stuck there.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just every, like, probably every apartment in New York, especially the older ones, especially in an apartment in a building like the Deptford, like they're all haunted.
Of course.
That makes sense.
There's a lot of history in these overcrowded rooms.
Apparently my building, when it was first built, every floor was one apartment.
Oh, yeah.
Which is insane, because now every floor is like six apartments.
Of course.
Oh, love it.
Oh, New York.
So you said that Rosemary's Baby and Salem's Lot were inspiration for the book. Why did you choose those two movies?
First off, they are so good. Like, I know that's a dumb answer, but like they're pinnacles of the genre and of that era of 70s horror that is like one of my all-time favorite eras of the genre. And the books too, like even probably more specifically, the books were influential. But they're also two books that happen to have incredibly faithful adaptations. So I've watched those movies hundreds of times, I'm sure. But so yeah, they're just like really good source material to kind of draw from anyway. But Rosemary's Baby in particular, as a novel and as a movie, which the movie is almost identical to the novel. It's very rare that this happens. But Ira Levin was such a great structural writer. And Rosemary's Baby as a story in any medium is just one of the most perfectly structured stories. So that was something I wanted to take inspiration from on the Rosemary's Baby side. Was just like, the way he puts that puzzle together is so perfect. And Salem's Lot is much less well structured. It's still really well structured, especially for a Stephen King, like wide angle lens panorama. That was his second book, and it's his first foray into like, you know, the big cast of characters. The entire town is kind of being dramatized. So it's a sprawling novel, but he takes a lot of structural inspiration from Dracula. The book is basically Dracula on a number of levels. But I especially wanted to draw from Salem's Lot how the vampires are scary. And they are, it's one of Stephen King's scariest books. I think a lot of Stephen King has scary moments and scary ideas. And he's such a master at drawing compelling characters that we are scared for them. But there's not a ton of Stephen King books where I think you leave the experience still scared. There are a few, and they're great, and we love them. And this isn't to detract from the less scary stories, but I think a lot of the scares of Stephen King happen while you're reading them, and you know, because you're scared for these characters that you're so invested in. But Salem's Lot is one of his few where like the dread never goes away, and like there are images in that book that just like stick with you and scare you. And so I really wanted to draw inspiration from that too, like how he takes this panoply of characters, this wide angle lens for this town, and uses vampires as a way to like actually wring physical fear out of the reader. And the Tobe Hooper adaptation too, like, has just some of the scariest imagery. It's a fucking TV movie from the 70s, and yet there are images from that adaptation that are so dreadful, so effective. So I wanted to take the structure of Rosemary's Baby and the effective scariness from Salem's Lot, and the discourse of vampires that are in Salem's Lot. There, you'll see in the second half of the novel when you get there, there's a lot more discussion of vampirism as a as an idea, and specifically from the Jewish angle. And a lot of that comes from Salem's Lot and my love of Salem's Lot, and just wanting to like investigate that source material through this different lens.
Very interesting. I have a confession. I've never seen Salem's Lot.
Oh, you're in for a treat then. Yay. It's really fucking good.
Yeah. Vampires are like not totally my thing. For some reason, just drinking blood grosses me out more than like somebody getting their throat slashed.
Yeah.
But I did watch 30 Days of Night for the first time this week, as well as The Lost Boys. I watched that last week. So yeah. I'm getting my fill of the vampires.
You're drinking deep. God. Yeah. Salem's, you might really dig Salem's. Make sure you watch the full version, because there was a feature edit of it that is not very good. But the full miniseries, I think it's like 3 hours or something like that. It's almost one full Beau's Afraid, but they screened it over several nights. It is, you know, it was a TV movie in like, I want to say like 78, 77, 78. So it's not bloody. You don't really see any like drops of blood or anything like that. And it's not very gory or anything like that. And some of it is creaky as hell. Like some of it is like, we're talking like green face makeup and, you know, things like that. But the moments of actual effective fear and terror, whether you like vampires or not, they're so well structured. And what he really does, what the story does really well, is it's less about vampires as a monster, and it's more about vampirism as almost like a plague. It's almost like a plague story of just watching it spread through this community that's already corrupt, and there's already all these horrible things happening that people are doing to each other. And so you watch why this environment is so ripe for vampirism to take root in it, and that's where the dread and the fear really comes from. So it's really it's very different from most other vampire stories, which tend to be about like the one big bad, and like it's you know, the vampires are scary because they've got fangs and they're drinking our blood and stuff like that, or that's what makes them romantic, or you know, it's less about the vampire as the monster and more about what this sort of endemic force does to a community. It's really interesting.
Oh, okay, yeah, that sounds really interesting. I'll have to check that. Speaking of Rosemary's Baby, have you seen the movie The Nightmare? It's newer. It's Norwegian. It's like their Norwegian modern Rosemary's Baby.
I don't think I have. Ooh, I'm excited.
Yeah, I think it just came to like a Hulu or a Shudder or something like that. But yeah, it's Norwegian modern day Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. I love Scandinavian horror. It's fucking great. Yeah. I love it. I will definitely check that out. Yeah. I've seen The Nightmare. I think it was called The Nightmare. That documentary on sleep paralysis.
It's not that. I know that.
Also terrifying.
I haven't watched it yet. I don't think I've ever dealt with sleep paralysis, and I don't want it to wake anything up in my brain.
Yeah. Yeah. That was my big fear watching that movie. It was like, I hope this doesn't give it to me.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it was real scary.
Though I did one day I went to bed in my bedroom, and then I woke up on the couch, and I sort of remembered walking in, but I don't remember why I went to sleep. Back to sleep on the couch, and I was like,
oh man,
all right, I'm gonna go back to sleep. So I see you have two guitars behind you, and the protagonist Reed, or one of the protagonists, is also a musician. Is anything about Reed based on yourself?
Reed is based on the worst version of myself I can imagine. Yeah, he is. It's been really interesting because, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but certain choices are made by the characters, both of them, where readers may have strong opinions on these choices. and many of the responses to Reed as a character have been very negative. Like, in the good way, in the way that it was effective. But there are a lot of people that are like, I fucking hate Reed. Reed's such a piece of shit. And, you know, he's already struggling with the baggage that any husband or boyfriend character has in a horror movie anyway. You know, horror movie husbands already have a lot of baggage because they tend to also make a lot of really bad decisions. And I tried to temper that as best as I could with Reed. But Reed is also based on my, I wrote this book as a kind of examination of my wife and I of the year that we had. There's an afterword to the book that goes into this in great detail. So you'll know this when you get there, but my wife and I had a year. We had 2021 for us was just this astonishingly horrible year. Like, the quick rundown is in January on the 6th. In fact, the morning of January 6th, my wife's mom died. Then 13 days later, my mom died. Then a couple of months later, one of our best friends died. Then a couple of months later, our dog and our cat died on the same weekend. And then a couple of months later, my dad died. And so just all of these things happened within 12 months. Like, our entire family was just wiped away. And on top of all this, my wife was, for about 18 months, essentially bedridden. She had this like mystery chronic pain that was just agonizing. She couldn't get out of bed. And, you know, this was all during the height of the pandemic, too. So we were just like stuck at home. She couldn't move without like shrieking agony. She saw like something like 40 doctors. No one could diagnose what was going on. And at the same time, until the weekend that they died, our pets were also so fucked up physically and medically. They had so many issues. And, you know, we love them to death. They were our children surrogates, basically. But like, our dog had cancer and dementia, and our cat had kidney problems. So there was just like pills and feeding schedules and cleanup and just all these really intensive caretaking things that had to be done for them. And we were going to put them down prematurely because we love them and they were still like enjoying their lives. They were still eating and stuff like that. It was just like so much care. And our dog in particular, because of her physical issues and her canine dementia, she would wake up at 4 a.m. and usually like paw me awake, or I would basically spring out of bed the minute I heard her tags jingle, and I would have to take her out. And then I would, for like every 15 minutes, I would have to take her out again and again and again. And she wouldn't fall asleep until midnight. And my wife couldn't do it because she was laid up in agony. So for a good 18 months then, you know, my wife is in complete misery. I am sleep deprived in a way I've never experienced before, like literally 4 hours of sleep total for 18 months, 4 hours of sleep a night, taking care of these animals. So it was just an experience I was not prepared for at all, emotionally or logistically. And, you know, so the two of us were just in this holding pattern of insanity. And we were both so physically miserable and so just kind of adrift and like just trying to day to day was just like, what the fuck is going on? What are we doing? All of which is to say, Reed is kind of inspired by, you know, those really dark moments I think anyone in a caretaking position has experienced, where you're like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I want to do this. I don't know if I have the ability to do this, you know, and those feelings of resentment that bubble up, and especially when you're like super sleep deprived too. And that those feelings of just impotency of like, the creatures that I care the most about have, you know, they're not trying to make like the caretaker the object of sympathy here. Like, they have it so much worse, but like, I can't do anything to help them. Like, you know, I can't make this pain go away. I can't make these problems go away. And so that real feeling of just like, I can't fucking do anything. And, you know, that panic that you feel. Reed is based on all of those feelings and kind of the worst case scenario of what that can do to a person. I am very grateful that I never did the things that Reed did. But like, I drew that character from those inclinations. And yes, so making him a musician, which I also am, was a way to like really ensure that there was that connection to that character. And again, I'm not him. He's very much a worse version of me, but it's based on kind of those worst case impulses and thoughts that I think anyone in that position had. So when I read people being like, fuck Reed, he's a piece of shit, there is a part of me that's like, no, oh, I feel like in an alternate universe, I probably could have been something like a Reed, and I'm very glad I wasn't. But yeah, it's a little bracing to see people detest him so much.
Oh, that's really interesting, and I'm glad you're through all of that.
Thank you.
Is your wife feeling better?
Yeah, eventually she found the right doctor and the right physical therapist, and it's night and day. Like the pain still comes occasionally, and there are, you know, some issues attached to it and stuff like that. But yeah, everybody is in a much better place. So it's that is very much a relief. Thank you for asking. Yeah.
At least there wasn't a newborn thrown into the mix.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, there wasn't. Yeah. We probably would have all just like disappeared into a puff of smoke by that point. We had like one more stressor added to what we were dealing with.
Yeah. So there's a really claustrophobic feel to nestlings. And you said that you were just stuck inside. So I'm assuming the pandemic, as well as your experiences afterwards, inspired that feeling.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah. It is very much a New York novel, not just for the reasons we've already discussed of like real estate and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But for that, you know, experience during the height of the pandemic where, you know, first there was that, you know, March 2020 to the end of 2020, just, I moved here a couple of years after 9/11. So I didn't experience 9/11. I knew a lot of people who experienced it and kind of got a lot of secondhand experience of 9/11, but I didn't directly experience it. This, though, experiencing the pandemic as a New Yorker was a trauma I think we're still kind of unpacking, and we've kind of like siloed it away. I think we haven't quite confronted it, but to like be stuck in an apartment in a building with a bunch of other people while there are ambulances whizzing by all hours of the day, like our street that we lived on in our apartment during the height of the pandemic was a route to the hospital. So there were just nonstop ambulances and people dying left and right, mass graves in like Roosevelt Island or something like that, and the portable morgues and yeah, things like that. Like I know everybody's experience of the pandemic was awful, but when, you know, when we live in such tight quarters and like you can hear your neighbors coughing, there's a great movie. I don't know if you've seen it, called The Harbinger. Have you seen that?
I love that.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. It's like one of my favorite pandemic horror movies. Yeah.
It's one of the few that like really captured what it was like to be living in the city at the time. Mm-hmm. And just like not knowing if it was safe to go in out into your hallway.
Yeah.
To, like, pick up your delivery or something like that. Like people who lived in houses had a very different experience of the pandemic than like actual apartment dwelling New Yorkers. And the fact that it like just hit here first. And so we were all just like, oh, we don't know what's going on. So yeah, I wanted to capture those feelings in this New York story. And also, you know, it's Nestlings is set again in like a slightly post-pandemic world. We don't deal with the pandemic. If you're triggered by pandemic stories, it's very much in the background. Like it's not an active element to the story, but it does try to capture that feeling that I think all New Yorkers felt after we were allowed to go back outside again. And like, you know, people are still have masks in their pocket and stuff like that. Like there are references to that in the book, but it's trying to depict that very weird feeling directly afterwards when it kind of felt like the pandemic was behind us, but physically we hadn't let go of that like tension of being around other people, or like being on the train and someone's coughing and you just have that like little twinge of like, oh God, like we're still so densely packed and, you know, the trauma is still just kind of humming in the background and you just don't know if what we're doing is right. It's that kind of feeling that I wanted to capture of like, I don't know, should we be doing this? Are we making the right decision? You know?
Yeah, you definitely successfully captured that. So if anyone wants to know what it was like to be in New York City, a little bit post-pandemic, read Nestlings.
Watch The Harbinger and then
right? Yeah, you can do like a double feature. Just do a whole day. Read the Nestlings and then, yeah.
Just feel terrible.
Yeah. So, but on that note, is there, you know, any chance we'll get a film adaptation of Nestlings any time in the future?
That's the hope. Mary has been optioned. Mary's with somebody, with something of a very exciting place. Ooh. That I don't know if I'm specifically allowed to mention. But Nestlings, the writer strike just ended for those listening in the future. It just ended like a couple of weeks ago. And my film and TV reps really want me attached to adapt it. So we couldn't shop it around because I was on strike as a writer. And so those conversations are like just starting to happen now. I've got a couple of meetings lined up and it's in the hands of some other people. So hopefully that's the hope. And for the first time too, like I don't really have a clear idea or preference if this is like a feature or a series. Everything else I've written, I love miniseries. Like I love, speaking of Salem's Lot, I love the ability to tell a story over like 4 to 8 episodes. Like I love that. So like Mary very much wants to be a limited series, and that's what it's optioned for. But Nestlings, I'm like, I don't know. It could be a feature. It could be a limited series. Who knows? So hopefully there'll be something to announce one of these days.
If you had your dream cast, who would be Anna and Reed?
Man. I mean, selfishly, I would love to play Reed.
Okay, that's
if
fair.
I were allowed. Someone else asked me this the other day, and I was also ill-prepared for it, and I kind of waffled. But I sort of like my answer, so I don't. They might be a little young, but Zendaya and Tom Holland, I was like, they have really good chemistry. That would be fun. And, you know, Spider-Man's such a New York story, so let's have Spider-Man and Mary Jane playing these characters. Why not?
Oh, nice. Yeah, those are interesting picks. And in a couple of years, they'll be a little bit older.
Yeah, exactly. It'll take time to adapt anyway.
Since you like horror series, have you started watching The Fall of the House of Usher yet?
I have. Yeah, I'm 2 episodes into it. I just finished the second episode.
Yeah, I'm 5 episodes in. So yeah, it's really good. My boyfriend is watching it with me, and it's his first time watching anything Mike Flanagan.
Oh, really?
So he's loving it.
So, oh, yay.
Yeah, I can keep him around.
Yeah.
So I loved how you used New York City as the setting for this. Have you ever visited any haunted, supposedly haunted spots in New York City?
That's a great question. I mean, besides the answer that you already alluded to, that every space is haunted in this city, have I? I don't think I really have. Not like a specifically haunted place. I remember when I first moved to the city. I moved here in 2004.
Me too.
And no shit. Oh, yay. Class of 2004. I was living in Williamsburg. My first like 4 or 5 apartments were all in Williamsburg and Bushwick. And so the Williamsburg pool hadn't been revamped. It hadn't been turned into what it is now, which is like a concert venue and super fancy place. But the first time I walked around hip Williamsburg, you know, the Bedford area and stuff like that, literally like a few months after I'd moved here, the pool was like, it almost looked like a condemned hospital. Like it was a space that you did not go in. And so I wandered around the husk of what would eventually be revitalized. And that felt very haunted. That felt like I was in like a haunted hospital or something like that. But no, I don't think I have. I should change that. Have you experienced some like New York haunted areas?
I've never felt a haunting before, and I never want to if there are any ghosts listening. But I am going to the Merchant's Sea House tonight, which is supposedly like one of the most haunted buildings in New York. And they do like a candlelit ghost tour several times a weekend during October. So,
Ooh. Yeah. Are you dreading it or are you excited?
Oh, no, I'm looking forward to it. I don't think anything's going to happen. But like, yeah, I'm not one of those people that goes to like haunts, like really extreme haunts and like wants to be grabbed. Like,
yeah,
I went to Sleep No More back in 2011 when it first opened.
Yeah.
And that is one where they come and grab you. And I was like, please get your hands off me.
Yeah, I don't enjoy that either. That's easy.
I grabbing like my horror on screen.
Them? Yeah, don't go for the cheap scare and just startle me. I hate that.
Yeah, but I really like listening to the Bowery Boys because they do an episode on like different places that are haunted in New York every October. So there's like 12 years worth of episodes.
Oh, I'll check that out.
Yeah. So can we talk about the horror plays that you've written before?
Sure.
Yeah. Tell me about them.
Yeah, I've written, I want to say like 14 full-length plays. And then a whole bunch of one acts and short plays. They have spanned from my most commercially successful, the one that's been done in the most theaters and has been done regionally a bunch of times. That one was written in 2009, so it was like right before, or it was written in 2008. It was produced the first time in January of 2009, but so it was a little before the big zombie boom and everyone got all sick of zombies. But it was kind of a zombie Long Day's Journey into Night in a way. It's about a family. There's a rash of it's kind of set at the beginning of what appears to be the zombie apocalypse. So there's only been like a few documented cases of this happening, but dead bodies are starting to come back to life and wander around. But the twist is that they're not violent. They just are literally reanimated corpses who are, as far as we can tell, not like cognizant. They're just kind of moaning and groaning and walking into walls and stuff like that. And this family in Connecticut finds their dead dad wandering in the backyard, and who would be in like his 70s, who's like the patriarch. And his widow, their mom, takes him in and cleans him off, and she's clearly not ready to say goodbye to him. So she's just keeping this reanimated corpse in their house. And the two elder daughters have to try and figure out what to do with this. And like, one is very much, you could tell it was written during the height of the 2008 election, which was back when we thought that's how crazy politics could ever get.
That's the
But
worst it could ever be.
yeah, exactly. Oh, we were so young. So the eldest sister is like this very frustrated local politician who's very much modeled after like Sarah Palin, and she thinks that they should kill the dad again. And the younger sister is much more, they're both middle aged, but the younger sister is much more like hippy dippy and thinks maybe there's greater meaning to what is happening. And so she doesn't agree with that. But the politician sister then decides to fake a zombie bite and bites a chunk out of her own arm, and then calls the authorities and says, "My dad tried to bite me. These zombies are deadly and dangerous, and we need to kill them all." And basically rides to fame on this platform of, "We need to kill all the zombies." But it's all set in this family's kitchen. And the tension between the two sisters boils over until eventually the bad sister murders the younger sister, who is getting in the way of her ambitions. That sister comes back, and the hatred between the two of them has mutated the zombie virus in a way that the reanimated dead younger sister rips a chunk of the older sister's neck and basically starts bad zombies from there. Their bad blood changes the nature of this virus that is being transmitted, if it is a virus. They never, actually go into that, but the hatred that these two people have now has made a new kind of zombie. So it's like I go into detail on that just as like an example of like what I tend to do with horror on stage is take genre tropes and try and find like the microcosm, the like smaller story that is more dramatizable on stage, and like drill into that. So they are, the thing I find most compelling and effective about horror theater is that you don't really have the advantage of special effects. You don't have the ability to focus an audience's eye on one small thing the way a camera does. You have a whole stage, and you have an audience that can look wherever they want at any time, and you can't do like, huge spectacular things. So it has to be like, what about these relationships and this dynamic is terrifying, and can you get dread out of? So I love evoking dread and feelings of unease and like a slow building sense of fear that only plays can really get you. I'm a big fan of like hiding speakers in the audience and just like playing like a low note that they don't even like
Oh,
know that they're
interesting.
hearing,
Oh,
so
my
that they're
God.
just like, "I feel unsettled." One of my most successful New York plays was a very loose adaptation of an H.P. Lovecraft story reset during World War II in a sunken submarine. So we turned the theater into the control room of a submarine, and
Oh,
everyone was
wow.
kind of in cramped quarters, pipes like just barely above their head. And you watched this crew of German submariners, of Kriegsmarine soldiers, basically die of oxygen starvation. And so there were, again, like you know, speakers hidden all over the theater that were just like whispering voices and like playing like surreal sound effects. So everyone had like a slightly different experience of it. And as these characters are hallucinating more and more through the oxygen deprivation, the audience is also getting this really surreal feeling. So yeah, I love that. There's a type of horror that only live theater can evoke that I just absolutely adore. And I'm always hungry to try and find new ways to do.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely agree. What can you say the title of the play, the first one that you were talking about?
Oh, yeah. The first one is called Any Day Now.
Any Day Now. Okay, I'm going to have to go find that at the drama bookshop and read it.
I think there's an older version of it in some collections and stuff like that. And it's so fun. It's also one of those plays that it's been anthologized in a bunch of like monologue books for students and stuff like that.
Oh,
so I'm
fun.
Constantly. Yeah. Oh, it's a huge honor. Cause like as a theater student too, like I loved those books, but the problem is I'll constantly like once every like 3 or 4 months get an email from a student being like, I got this monologue and I really want to do it. Can you send me the play so that I can like, you know, figure out what the context is. And I always have to explain to them, like, I can, but that version of the play doesn't actually exist anymore because that they pulled that monologue from like a production draft when the play was being produced.
Oh.
And since then, the play had this workshop at Primary Stages, this off-Broadway workshop that completely changed it. And that character changed most of all. So there's actually not a published version of that play where those monologues actually exist because it's basically a different character. So I have to be like, you can read a version of the play that is old and not as good for context clues, but that play actually doesn't really exist anymore.
Oh, that's so interesting. Where was the submarine play produced? What theater was that at?
That was at the Brick in Williamsburg.
Brick, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Is that theater still around?
It is. It's under new management. So it's kind of different, and I haven't been there since, so I don't know if they've like reorganized the space. But yeah, the Brick was one of my favorite places to produce. My two favorite places were Manhattan Theater Source, which is where Any Day Now went up, and a whole bunch of my other plays. That's now completely vacant. This is a vacant building. And then the Brick was kind of second home base. They're doing really exciting things there as far as I've heard, but I have not been back since. So I should change that.
Yeah, you should write another play and go back. And I love how you talk about like seeing like a horror play can evoke such a sense of dread, which is why I've always sort of wanted somebody to adapt Hereditary into a stage play. Because I
it would
feel
be great.
Like that could be done really easily. I mean, Ari Aster just calls it a family drama.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, the scariest moment of that show is like the kitchen table conversation.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that could totally be a play.
Yeah. What are your favorite horror plays that you've seen that you haven't written?
Damn, that's hard because there's so few and it's been so long. I mean, I came up as a playwright alongside a few other playwrights like Clay McLeod Chapman, who has also since moved on to being a brilliant horror novelist. And he had this long running horror theater series called The Pumpkin Pie Show. It was pretty much all monologues. I did, to my knowledge, I think I'm correct in this because I think I pretty much saw everything. There was never like a play. There was never like a play proper. There were some monologue nights where there was like a little bit of dialogue in between the monologists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they often had like a theme that tied them all together. Like there was one that was about a cruise ship where horrible things are happening. And there's a, like a stomach. It was kind of like, what the fuck was that movie that just came out? Now I'm blanking on the name. Yeah, it's escaped my head. But it was basically like a stomach bug sweeps through a cruise ship and it's just all the horror stories that are happening therein. So they were often like linked and telling like a larger narrative, but they weren't like plays per se. But those were always so much fun. And some of them were so uncomfortable to sit through. And then there's another playwright who's a dear friend of mine and of Clay's as well, Mac Rogers, who's written some great. His passion mostly is for sci-fi, but he's written some horror and crime and stuff like that. And he actually writes brilliant audio dramas. So people might be familiar with his work as an audio dramatist. Maybe my favorites were, I used to be a staff writer of a Grand Guignol sort of horror troupe called the Blood Brothers, who started out also at the Brick. There was a theater company called Nosedive. And it was these two just delightful, bald, white, like face painted white with red eyes. Patrick Shearer and Pete Boisvert were the performers and the writers. And they would take news stories and write one acts about, you know, kind of fictionalized versions of these news stories done in the Grand Guignol fashion. So like super violent, super gory, just delightful horror special effects on stage and stuff like that. And the Blood Brothers would be the hosts. They were kind of like, you know, almost like Crypt Keeper-esque. And that over the years, then they started bringing a couple, they brought me and Mac and then one other writer, Jack McCarthy. And you know, actually, they had other writers as well, Jesse Gatta, and Clay might have even written one, to just like contribute one acts, dramatizing the most horrible things you could imagine and depict on stage while their hosts kind of gleefully introduced everything. So I wrote a bunch for that. But then some of the ones that I either performed in or just got to witness were so gnarly and gross and delightful. And fun. So those definitely have my heart. The Blood Brothers series definitely has my sentimental favorite for horror theater.
Oh, that's fun. I remember seeing a play back in maybe 2010. It was by Adam Rapp. It was the Hallway Trilogy.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I remember when that was up. I didn't get to see it.
Oh yeah. That was three nights at the theater, and the final night is they're using the hallway as a place where where rich people come and watch poor people get injected with now extinct diseases.
Oh, Jesus.
So yeah, that was fun. I'm going to see on Sunday night, I'm going to see Saw the musical parody. And on Monday night, I'm going to see Exorcist the musical. I'm assuming it's a parody. I don't know.
I hope so. I hope they're not trying to do it straight as a musical.
Yeah. So I imagine that you haven't had much time with, you know, writing your book and finishing it and now promoting it now that it's out. But what has your favorite new horror movie been that you've seen in 2023?
Nothing makes my mind go blank faster than trying to remember what I've fucking seen. God, what has been my favorite? Let's see, because I'm so bad at this, I do keep a list in my notes app of like my favorite things I've seen lately, or like what are my favorite things in general, because I will always forget. Are any of these from this year? Did Incantation come out this year? It might have.
No, I don't know.
That was last year?
Incantation, I think, was maybe, oh yeah, it was 2022.
2022, yeah. I know there's something. Oh, did Satan Slaves 2 come out this year, or was that last year? That might have been this year. Satan Slaves 2 : Communion, I think is the full name.
That's 2022, but if it's a new movie you saw, that's fine.
Only released in America in 2023. I don't know. I watch a ton of, as I've already said, like foreign horror tends to be my favorite.
Yeah.
And Indonesia has such a great horror scene right now. And the reason why I was thinking of Satan Slaves 2 is because I definitely saw Evil Dead Rise this year and I enjoyed it. I thought it was a ton of fun, but Satan Slaves 2 is also set in an apartment complex and it's everything
nice.
I wanted Evil Dead Rise to be. Even though I enjoyed Evil Dead Rise, there were a few punches pulled in Evil Dead Rise, I thought. And Satan Slaves 2 does not pull any punches and is so fucking terrifying and set in an apartment complex. And, you know, is one of the things I love about foreign horror, too, is that it gives you all these windows into other cultures, into other traditions and stuff like that. And it's about a very specific funeral rite that is not like, you know, common to all of Indonesia, but to certain areas of it. And so it was just like fascinating to see it play out and also just totally terrifying. So if people like apartment set horror or want like some sort of apartment set horror, first, you should watch Satan Slaves. The first movie, which is in and of itself an adaptation of an 80s movie called Satan Slave, I think. But Satan Slaves came out a couple of years ago. Same director, Joko Anwar, directed these two new versions of it. So it's some of the same characters, but they're both so good. But the sequel is so, so good. I know there are other movies I've seen this year. I don't know. Do you have a favorite that you've seen this year? Maybe that'll remind me of movies that have come out?
I want to say I'm looking at my Letterboxd. I think Cobweb has been one of my favorites this year, which was in.
I'm waiting for that to come out on Hulu so I can see it.
Yeah, it's out as of yesterday, so you can watch it
Oh,
now.
great. Yay.
Yeah. Yesterday being the 20th, since we're recording on the 21st.
But you
Yeah.
enjoy that?
Yeah, it's really, there's a lot of atmosphere. It's very spooky. It keeps you guessing until the end. Yeah, I did enjoy Scream 6, and I really liked Evil Dead Rise. So, and
That's
but
right,
Saw,
Scream 6. Yes, I really
yes.
enjoy that.
Yes. And Saw 10 was really good. And I'm not really big into torture porn, but
Yeah.
it was a good installment. So,
I've been hearing really good things about Saw 10, even from people who don't like Saw, which I kind of fall into that camp too. Like I it's not my favorite franchise by a long shot. And you're right, Scream 6. I'm buddies with one of the directors, with Tyler Gillette, who's an amazing human being and such a talented director. So I got to see the screening of that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was really, really cool. And yeah, I loved it. I think that is actually one of the best New York horror movies.
Except
Maybe.
it didn't look like New York.
I know there are always parts where you're like, ah, that's that. And everybody has a bigger apartment than they probably would. It was nowhere near as bad as like Midnight Meat Train, which is supposed to be set in the New York subway systems, and it's so. You've never seen a New York subway train look like that. I think it was filmed in Montreal. But yeah, it was like the bodega scene I thought was so great and like captured a New York sort of vibe in a way that like no other recent New York movie has ever done. It really might be the best New York slasher because there aren't that many.
Yeah.
Jason Takes Manhattan,
It's on a
certainly
boat.
not that. Yeah.
Yeah. My problem with Scream 6 and the New York setting was they're on the one train, and that one train does not stop for a really long time
Yeah.
when they're getting stabbed. And also, people would
Yeah.
have noticed that somebody's getting stabbed. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
They all would have noticed and been like, "We'll go call 911. We're going to go to the next car, though."
but that sequence was really fun. Yeah, no one gets New York trains quite right. I feel like Scream 6 came the closest, but there are things like Cloverfield made me so mad when they're like walking up like the I think they say they're like walking up the Lexington line or walking up the 456 line, and then suddenly they're at Columbus Circle. And it's like, what fantasy version of New York are
Well,
you living in?
no, they get out of the 6 train, and they're at that point where the 6 train would end at 59th, and then they walk over to Columbus
Oh,
Circle.
is that the oh, is
Yes.
that well, there was something about the geography of the subway tunnel that I remember being like,
They
that's not
walk
right.
it really fast.
Is that it? Is that what I'm remembering?
Probably.
Yeah, because they like enter at like Bleecker Street and suddenly they're in the 50s in like 5 minutes or something like that. Yeah, there was something about that movie bugged me. That movie made me mad.
Are there any horror movies that you love that people generally don't like?
That's a good question. Are there? Nothing is coming to mind. I tend to not like a lot of movies that people like. It tends to be kind of in the reverse. Like I'll watch a movie that everybody loves and I'll be like, meh. But then at the same time, there are always like elements about it that I love. So I'm on one hand like a very easy audience, and I'm also like a really hypercritical audience. For me, it tends to be where I have a very like specific and hard to nail down window on the spectrum of horror and comedy. So if it is slightly too funny or trying to be too funny, I kind of immediately am like, this doesn't feel real. This doesn't feel right. And if it's slightly too serious, then I'm like, oh, this is fucking taking itself so seriously. And I hate it. There's like a very narrow needle eye to thread when it comes to humor for me. And like, it's been like a lot of like vibe based horror movies lately that like I enjoy, but I kind of don't like at the same, like I get kind of bored while watching it. There seems to be like a lot of horror movies where like the first two acts are just like someone wandering around in their lives, like, seeing scary things. And then the third act is like kind of crazy and starts to get interesting. But those first two acts, I'm like, come on, like this is a little boring. So I have to be in the right mood for that. But is there something I liked that other people don't? I'm sure there is something. Oh, I loved the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And
Oh, I
yeah,
liked
people fucking hated that movie. I
it
loved it. I thought it was so good. I thought it was a really good almost parody of like reboots and stuff like that. Like the way they brought Marion, is that her name? Now I'm blanking on the name, but the survivor from the original movie, the way they brought her back to kind of be like a Laurie Strode figure. And then they just fucking brutally kill her. I thought that was great. I was like, yeah, this is really funny. Like I feel like I saw a lot of people who thought it was taking itself seriously. And I read it as like almost satirical in a way. And so I thought it was really effective. Oh, you know what? The Smile too seems to be a movie where a lot of people didn't like it. And I loved it because I also thought it was really good. Yeah. Like it's really on the nose in the last act about like, this is trauma. This is trauma. And I thought it was kind of doing that in a purposeful way where it was almost, again, like sort of marrying the sort of Blumhouse horror aesthetic with the A24 aesthetic and being like, all right, you want a metaphor? Here's a fucking metaphor. Like, we're just going to make it the biggest metaphor imaginable. So I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I enjoyed both of those movies too. I find the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre a little boring. Nothing happens. I mean, yeah, so I really enjoyed the updated version in 2022.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you could remake one horror movie, which one would it be?
That's a challenging prospect because it can't be a movie that I like, because then why would I want to remake it? And if it's a movie I didn't like, why would I want to bother with it in the first place? There are a lot of Stephen King adaptations where I wish they were better, and there are plenty that are really good too. Ooh, I'm going to say something controversial. This probably isn't the right answer for this question, but this is where my mind is going, because we already talked about Mike Flanagan, and I love Mike Flanagan. I think he's a superior craftsman. I think he understands character really well. I think he balances humor and horror really well. So my jury is still out on Usher at the moment, because there's some things that I'm like, this is trying to be a little funny, a little too funny. I love the first, I forget if it's 8 episodes, 7 episodes. I love all of the episodes of the Haunting of Hill House adaptation. I hate that last episode so much. So if I could remake just that hour of TV, just make a few tweaks, I feel like something inside me would feel better. Because like it's not something I talk about that often, because I love Mike Flanagan. I would kill to work with him. I think he's brilliant. But I fucking hate that episode so much. So like I don't talk about it, and the first few episodes are so good. Like I think that show is so good. So can that count as my answer? I would remake that.
That's a really interesting answer. I loved The Haunting of Hill House. I've never gone back to rewatch it because I've never wanted to be that depressed again. So
that's part of what I hated about the ending. The ending like tries to be so sappy and sensitive and like sentimental, and it takes, you know, I don't know if you've read the book.
Yeah.
But it's one of the most famous lines in all of horror literature of, you know, how whatever walked in Hill House walks alone. And like the final line of the series is that like whatever walks in haunted in Hill House like walks together or something. Like it tried to like subvert it and make it like this like sha-na-na-na sort of moment. And it made me so mad. So like, yeah, I would even probably just like make some strategic edits and maybe it would work better for me. So I'm sorry, Mike, if you ever stumble upon this episode, if you're listening right now, I'm sorry that's how I feel, but that's how I feel.
I hope Mike Flanagan listens to this, and Mike, please come on my show.
Yes, you should do. You would be a fucking great guest on this show, Mike.
My last question is, if you had to spend quarantine with one horror villain, who would it be?
The Babadook might be fun. He seems like a fun guy. Your episode with Josh Rubin, he had a great answer for this that I kind of can't not think of when I hear this question now. And so I don't want to give it, but also it was just such a good point where like, you know, if you're rooming with Pinhead, he can take you to other places. And so why wouldn't you want to quarantine with Pinhead? That was just such a good answer. And like, I can't not think of that as my answer now. Definitely wouldn't want any of the slashers because they're boring. Definitely wouldn't want like Samara because she would hog the TV. Yeah, I'm gonna steal Josh's answer and say, or maybe I will not steal Josh Rubin's answer, but I will use Josh Rubin as the protagonists in Scare Me. I'd love to quarantine with them. They were both kind of villains because they tell stories. And like, I know they're fucking a lot to deal with and it doesn't end well for them. But, you know, I feel like we'd get a lot of writing done and that would be nice.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great answer. Thank you so much for being here. I know we went a little over, but do you want to tell everyone where they can find you online and where they can go buy Nestlings?
Yeah, I'm on all the social media platforms. I've kind of stopped using them very frequently, which is dumb of me because I need to be promoting my work and stuff. I'm there if you want to find me. I'm usually Nat Cassidy at all of them, TikTok and Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. Instagram, I'm Cat Nassity because Nat Cassidy was taken. So you can find me there. Also, my website, natcassidy.com, which I do not update anywhere near as I should. That tends to be running on like a 6-month delay, but I'm there. You can find me there. And yeah, Nestlings should be available at bookstores everywhere. Support your indie bookstores. Maybe try and find it at a Shakespeare and Company where I used to work, or any other indie bookstores, or Barnes & Noble. There's so few Barnes & Nobles now anyway, if you got to do Barnes & Noble. It's also on Audible. It's a really fucking fantastic audiobook read by Cassandra Campbell, if you like audiobooks. And the audiobook of Mary, too, I always recommend is like the best way to experience Mary because that narrator, Susan Bennett, is so brilliant. So yeah, it should be available everywhere when you hear this. And if it's not, then you demand a copy. You make them order it on my behalf, please. And yeah, so you should be able to get it everywhere.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. And I will see you soon.
Yay. Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode of Who's There. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Nat Cassidy, and thanks again to Nat for coming on. I'll leave links to his socials in the show notes and where you can pick up your own copy of Nestlings. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Who's There PC, and if you have any questions, comments, concerns, horror movie recommendations, or you'd like to be a guest, shoot us an email at whostherepc@gmail.com. Have a happy Halloween, and until next time, stay scary and never ask who's there.